Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A lot of frustrated golfers in St. Louis are waiting for the weather to make up its mind. The winter's been tough on them, especially watching the pros play in Hawaii, out west, and in Florida all winter. Not much opportunity to play around here yet. Whether you're a golfer or not, there's plenty of reason to be proud of our region's role in the golf world. The new head of the USGA, the U.S. Golf Association, golf's governing body, is St. Louis and Tom O'Toole, a local attorney. Curtis Cup competitors from the U.S., Britain, and Ireland will meet for the biennial match here in June. The U.S. team is captained by Ellen Port, a native St. Louisan and five-time USGA champion. Jim Holtgreve of St. Louis has played both as an amateur and a professional and has been captain of this country's Walker Cup team, the amateur men's counterpart to the Curtis Cup. Jim Holtgreve, Tom O'Toole, and Ellen Port join me in studio. Thank you very much for being with us. I'm willing to bet that every one of you would rather be on a golf course right now, as would I, as a matter of fact.
Good to be here, Don.
Yes, sir.
Nice to see you all. Tom, let me begin with you. How would you say St. Louis shapes up as a golf town?
Well, I'd like to think if you look at our track record over the last 20 years and how the communities rallied around the events, whether they were USGA championships like the two people on my right and left have won and carried the flag on, or whether they were the pro events that were brought here either in the LPGA or the Champions Tour or the PGA Tour or the PGA of America. I think they've stepped up and shown that they're a great golf community, that they support golf, and that they care about the game. And if you look at our track record in those events compared to other cities, and why you don't want to speak disparagingly about other communities, you can quickly conclude that St. Louis put their best foot forward and shine in each one of those instances.
And it's produced a lot of very well-known players, very successful players over the years.
Well, two of them are right here in the studio.
I know.
And that, of course, present company is excluded. But, yeah, great. Two of the greatest amateur golfers ever to compete nationally or internationally right here in your St. Louis Public Radio studios here this afternoon. So, and a lot of good other players and certainly from across the river, the Haas brothers, and we've enjoyed some nice successes in both amateur and professional golf.
Sure, names like Bob Golby come to mind, and Hale Irwin, and people like that. Ellen, same question to you. You've been around all over the country, as Tom has just indicated, and other parts of the world. How does St. Louis stack up in your mind?
I, of course, ditto everything Tom said, and I'll go turn the chapter and talk about people like you that are the sports announcers. How about a guy like Jay Randolph? And I just was thinking about him in the context of the Curtis Cup and thinking all he's accomplished and what he's done for the game, him and his son, and the local radios. I mean, we get so much support with Dan Reardon. I know he's a coach, a high school golf coach, and he has been a huge supporter of women's golf. And I personally appreciate the media. You know, I got a call from the paper, you know, about this. And fortunately, I've had an opportunity to play golf with Dan O'Neill, and that was an experience of itself. But the community from the broadcasting and the coverage, and I think of junior golf, and I have contact with that because I coach high school and junior golf and have to call golf courses to get places for these kids to play. And I know other people are trying to do that. And from that standpoint, I think St. Louis is great as well.
Jim, I'll ask you to weigh in as well if there's anything left to say.
Probably shouldn't be hitting me with this one, but that's I love St. Louis, and I think St. Louis is very, very supportive of golf. I take a little different opinion than Ellen in regards to our media. I wish our media would be a little bit more proactive, not necessarily the writing media. I talk about the television media because golf in St. Louis has the ability to teach so many young people what the great life skills are. And to me, it is the greatest sport that there is. And I just get, when we have a national championship here, like the PGA, like we had the senior PGA 2013, and when we have some of these national championships, yeah, the media is all over it. But then when they're gone, then it becomes kind of quiet. So I would hope that we can get more media to cover golf because it teaches so many good things to our young people.
Well, there's certainly plenty of media attention to golf over the weekends. I mean, it's the networks are carrying it every weekend from January through whenever, I guess, pretty much close to November. Tom, do you share that idea that the local media doesn't do enough to cover the game?
Well, it's tough to come in this medium and be critical, but there's certainly been episodes that the media could have supported or been more vigilant and present at certainly amateur golf events in this region. But, you know, the dollar drives everything, and whether it's newspaper, print media, or radio media, there has to be a following, and they're going to put their efforts and capital towards where they think the following is. And you know, by and large, in many instances, they thought it wasn't in golf.
I wonder what percentage of Americans play golf. Do you have any idea?
Well, the National Golf Foundation would say 25 million to 27 million, somewhere in the estimate there, to play golf. Now, those aren't serious golfers. The serious golfers would be a number probably in the 5 million range in this country, focusing around who has handicaps and who plays multiple times a year.
Well, that's a pretty small number, given, you know, the 350 million population. A lot of people look at golf as being elitist, that it's really just for a certain segment of the population, and it's expensive. Do you think that has something to do with the way the media approaches it?
Well, I don't know if you read my remarks from my speech at the annual USGA annual meeting. I focused in much about that very problem. The game has certain, you know, we're going to celebrate a couple of wonderful careers here this afternoon and talk about whatever my USGA involvement is, but in the cold, hard analysis of this, the game's health is at risk, and it's at risk for some of the very points you just made, and that is it's not particularly welcoming. It's an expensive to play, and it takes too long to play in most instances. People in our society have changed their lifestyles. They want to do things quicker. You know, I can remember when I was getting out of law school and wanted to go to exercise or work out, people wanted to allow you to allot a couple hours to do that. Now you hear about 20-minute workouts and 30-minute workouts to try to achieve that objective because people are just busier and want to not spend as much time in one endeavor because our society's changed. We don't have people belonging to clubs like we used to. We have people that are playing the game more infrequently because of its time commitment and then other distractions, families and businesses and personal lives. It's just not it doesn't have the culture that it had in this country a few decades ago. So that's what we're working on. And we've got to put some energies, resources, and collective efforts from not just the USGA but people all around the game to try to improve that.
Well, we'll come back to that and get some ideas as to how that might happen. But, Ellen, let me turn back to you. I mean, you're a coach. What are you finding with the young people that you're coaching? And is there a general interest among the young people at the school in the game?
It's the same thing Tom said. They're spread really thin. There are a lot of choices for them. I personally, you know, our golfers at my school, we're competing to get golfers to play against some very popular sports, tennis, track, soccer, and lacrosse, which is in the boom right now, has taken a couple of my would normally be my strong golfers. But having said that, you know, and it does take a lot of time. And if you don't get kids interested in golf early, I think it's hard. I think you lose them. And so I really applaud the CYC program, for instance, just started 4 or 5 years ago, and they had all these other sports, but they didn't have golf. And they had 450 or 500 kids get started. And if you go on their website, you just see the pictures and of the youngsters that I don't think probably would have played unless they got plugged into that. So that is a real positive thing that's happening in our area.
Tell folks what your school is.
John Burroughs School. I've been there for 29 years. And a funny story is, you know, I worked in Kirkwood for 3 years and didn't even play golf. And went over to Burroughs and then picked up a golf club. And they've been very supportive of my one or two times I have to sneak out to play a tournament.
well, they should be. Jim, is part right. of this the fact that it's a tough game? It's a tough game to be even mildly proficient at. And that may turn some people away.
Well, there's no doubt. It is probably the hardest sport. It's because you compete against yourself. So it is challenging for young people. I mean, I'm very fortunate. My dad started me when I was 4 years old, So I've been playing a long time. And but I, when you get a chance, I spoke to the Marquette golf team last week, 30 young guys trying out for their golf team. And you could just see in their face that they're really excited about trying to make this golf team. And when you see the coaches like Ellen and you see the heart that they have about trying to promote this game, it's just, to me, it's obviously we have a challenge. And what Tommy was alluding to when he gave his great speech at Pinehurst, talking about what we have to do to grow the game. And that's why I'm really excited about Tom being president of USGA, because I think they're going to become refocused about that. And we need to try to grow it, because it does so many good things. As I've had the opportunity through Walker Cup and being involved with young people that I hadn't been involved with for a long time, we need to do more. But yeah, you're right. But all those things that you said were right. And I just want to make sure I don't get in trouble too much with me. like today, thank you so much for having us here so that we could talk about it. And the writing media, like I said, is very good. Bill Beck and Julie Ward way back when, and then, of course, Dan O'Neill. Everybody's been very kind to me. I just want to get more exposure, because there's a lot of great stories out there with high school and college golf in and around the St. Louis area.
And we should remind everyone that golf is a game that young people can start playing and play for the rest of their lives, unlike some of the other sports that I won't mention at this table.
Ellen? Well, I will tell you, I consider some of the most memorable times for me as a coach, taking the kid who had no knowledge, you know, about golf, and seeing the delight that they have when they're playing. And I love golf because it's 100% participation. You are not – I mean, you put a bucket of balls down in front of a kid, I'm telling you, they light up and they mm-hmm. love it. And I've seen that over the last 3 years. So,
well, I have a friend who says he taught his kids how to curse by teaching them how to play golf. That's part of the game, too, for a lot of folks, Tom.
Well, we don't want that to be the poster child of the game, that's for sure. But, Jim's right about the difficulty of the sport, and who can say that better than me, because I never played the game at the level these two did, but, you know, still had an affection for the game and an affinity to be around it. But I think the difficulty of the game is one of its charms, and that's why we are taking hard lines about bifurcating the rules or making different sets of rules for these two. And with my son's playing on the St. Louis U High golf team, should he have a different set of rules? And should, if I'm playing it in a senior mm-hmm. club event, should I have a different set of rules? You know, we've been very clear about that. And part of the reason is the charm is what this game is. Its difficulty is part of that. And to be able to play the same game these two plays, that there's some charm in some romanticism to that, too.
Yeah. What are some of your ideas for elevating the game and its popularity?
Well, Don and Jim and Ellen know this. We're careful about the vernacular, right? And we talk in the vein that we, the USGA, was formed in a room in New York City in December of 1894 for a couple primary purposes, and they were to conduct national championships and to write and interpret the rules. Since that time, we've acquired a number of other rulemaking functions, amateur status, equipment, handicap, to really continue on those focus, and we weren't supposed to be involved in growing the game. But what I said in Pinehurst, and what is, I think, the very notion that drives the USGA and both our governing board and our wonderful, talented staff today, is that if you're not going to be concerned with the game's health, then are we going to have a game to govern? And therefore, we have to touch on the periphery. And while they're not our core functions, and they weren't those things that were decided in that room in New York City in December of 1894, they are things that impact the game today. And while we still must do those really core governance responsibilities and do them with great conviction and diligence, we have to touch in these other areas and service the game and its golfers or players or people that frequent it. And that's got to be done by being concerned with the game's health. And that's all those things that we talked about, making it more welcoming, faster to play, and more cost efficient. So that's what we're going to be putting our energies in, particularly the accessibility one, because that strikes an accord with me, because I grew up in South St. Louis and saw people that ultimately, when I began to spend time around Jim Holtgreve, that couldn't come and play and compete against him because he was a country club player. And that barrier, I think, we tore down 25 years ago here. But the game's got other barriers, and it's got others. It's not accessible, and we need to make it more accessible. And if we do that, then we'll bring more people into the game. And that's when Ellen says you put a bucket of balls down in front of a kid and it resonates with them, then that's how you get people to draw in.
That's Tom O'Toole. He is the new head of the USGA. And we're talking golf on today's program. I'll remind listeners that they're listening to St. Louis on the Air. What about something like first tee? I hear a lot about that lately. I think Tiger Woods emerging into the game has really helped something like that along. Is that having an impact?
Oh, I think the first tee is, the first tee is not necessarily having an impact on opening up the game to people, but it's bringing people in the game and teaching them lessons, not only golf and the great principles on which it was built, which is why we all got attracted to it, but it's teaching them other life lessons. And they are making a difference on impacting kids to change their lives and go in a different direction because of golf. They're not making a huge impact as it relates to masses being attracted to the game because that's not their focus. But the First Tee has been a great organization. The USGA, by the way, is its largest contributing entity to the First Tee, and we will continue to put monies toward the First Tee because I think Joe Barrell has done a great job there. But it's not reaching the masses. It's focusing in on communities, the kids that are underprivileged and less fortunate, and they're making some strides. But we need more far-reaching tentacles.
It's basically geared to disadvantaged youngsters, isn't it?
Yeah, those who are disadvantaged or are uninitiated to the game and certainly underprivileged. Yeah. And to get them in to try to refocus them about life. It's a life skills program. It's not to try to it did produce Scott Langley and some players that have played at a high level. That's not their real role. That's not what they're trying to achieve.
Ellen, what can golf teach young people about life?
Tough. Is that the word we said? That life is tough. It's full of ups and downs, and you have to persevere. You have to take responsibility for your actions. I think that's one of the biggest ones, that when you sign your scorecard at the end, I just read a piece about integrity to my golf team yesterday about a Florida youth who had to call a penalty on himself. And just own up to you can't hide out there. I mean, you got to be honest with yourself, be responsible with yourself, accept that you – in golf, some wise woman once told me you lose more than you win, and I think it teaches you how to be how to lose and how to be and also how to be a gracious winner. So that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Jim, that's something you've had to learn when playing Ellen. Is that correct? from what I understand, she handles you pretty easily.
I don't want to play her. It teaches you that. It teaches you humility. It teaches you integrity. It teaches you a lot about yourself. I mean, I've certainly learned a lot about myself in the last 62 years playing the game. I want to piggyback on something, though. When you talked about first tee, we have a Tommy was right. When he started the Metropolitan Golf Association, Amateur Golf Association, 25 years ago, it was to break down some barriers where we could get all public players, everybody to play in these competitions and really learn the game. And we also have – I'm on the board of the Missouri Golf Foundation where we have kids that come in from Gene Slade's Boys Club and Kingdom House and Girls Incorporated, that we have a summer camp at the Highlands 6 weeks where we have the certified PGA professionals come in and teach, underprivileged kids. And we feed them, we teach them the game, and we also talk to them, as First Tee does, about life skills. And it's been very successful, and we're going to try to continue to build on that. But I think those things are important, and that's what I told the story the other day about how, I'll probably get in trouble again, but that's okay. But when Gary Player was a really good friend of mine, and Wayne Player, we played competition together, and I asked him if he was going to turn professional. And he said, no, I've got – South Africa has a mandatory law that you have to serve your country for 2 years, not necessarily going to war, but just to do something for your country. And I kind of wish we had that law here in the United States, because – our young people just need to learn about respect and humility and all the things that are important in life. golf teaches that.
I have to take a break, but I've always heard that you can tell an awful lot about a person if you play golf with them and the way they handle themselves.
Yes, sir. That's absolutely correct.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. Well, we have to take that break now. We're talking golf. We're talking about golf in the St. Louis region and even beyond that. My guests in studio are Tom O'Toole, who heads the U.S. Golf Association. Jim Holtgreve is with us, a former professional, an amateur golfer, and then amateur golfer once again. And also with us is Ellen Port, a multi-champion golfer and amateur golfer. She's with us and captain of this year's Curtis Cup team. Back to continue this conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We're going to be continuing our conversation on golf with Tom O'Toole of the U.S. Golf Association, amateur golf champion Ellen Port, and Jim Holtgreve, a former professional golfer and former Mid-America golf champion. But first, I have to do some news headlines, and here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Republican lawmakers are trying again to limit the ability of Missouri workers to collect unemployment benefits after being fired for alleged misconduct. The Senate passed legislation Thursday that would redefine what qualities or what qualifies as misconduct. Democratic Governor Jay Nixon vetoed a similar bill last year, saying it could have put Missouri at odds with federal law by permitting consideration of actions outside the job when denying unemployment benefits. U.S. Congresswoman Ann Wagner of Missouri will introduce legislation today that would criminalize the advertisement of sex trafficking victims. The bill targets online classified services such as Backpage.com. And Governor Jay Nixon and Representative Tommy Pearson will host a community meeting in North St. Louis County tonight to discuss reforming and expanding Medicaid in Missouri. State Budget Director Linda Lubering will also be on hand to provide an analysis of the budgetary implications of Medicaid reform and expansion. You can hear more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stopublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation about golf. Tom O'Toole, let me come back to you. A lot of people may not recognize what distinction there is between the PGA and the USGA.
Well, Don, it's an often asked question and one that many times when I speak on behalf of the USGA, I would lead in depending on the level of intellect of the audience on this very subject. And to try to draw the distinction between what is golf on TV on Sundays and which the PGA Tour, which is predominantly an entertainment industry, and the PGA of America, which is the golf professionals that are in the shops and clubs and facilities across this land trying to promote this growth of the game that we're talking about, and the USGA, which is, as you led in earlier, the governing body of the game. And so everybody uses our rules, and we govern that game jointly with the Royal and Ancient Golf Club in St. Andrews worldwide. So we are predominantly an amateur body. We conduct 13 national championships, including the U.S. Open, the Women's Open, and the U.S. Senior Open, but the rest of our championships are amateur championships. And other than that, we're a rulemaking body. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. So not always a popular part of the game, but it's a very necessary one. So that's the role the USGA plays within the other organizations.
I want to open our phone lines, by the way, and give our numbers so that members of the audience can get into this conversation. I'm sure many questions about golf. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. With regard to the rules, how does the USGA feel about people who are watching a PGA tournament and see an infraction and call up, and they're the ones that that call the foul, if you will?
Well, again, you must have done your homework, Mr. Morris, because you're hitting in on all these very critical and sensitive points within the game, so I applaud you for that. I've sat on the Rules of Golf Committee since 2004, and this is a question that's been talked about in depth and repetitively since. And here's where we come out on it. You know, most sports promote pushing the envelopes and the rules. So I never played professional sports, but let's just take football, for example. If Dan Dierdorf was sitting in here, my very dear friend and three-time Hall of Famer, he would tell you that he tried to hold, cheat, block illegally, whatever he could get away with that was within the purview or the eyesight of the referees. or if a basketball player would say that he would try to – Ellen was a competitive athlete before her golf endeavors, so she was a basketball player. So she hand-checked people and did things that really were in breach of the rules, but at least approached that line of them. That's not our game. Our game is, for all the things that Ellen and Jim said here this afternoon about its integrity, the self-policing aspect of this game. So I don't know anybody on the PGA Tour that I've met, and I've not always seen eye to eye with all of them, and the LPGA Tour for this matter as well, that would want to win a tour event, and there was a call-in when somebody saw a breach of a rule and it wasn't applied because they couldn't take that type of evidence. I don't know anybody that would want to do that that's in this game. Again, that's what attracts these people to this game or these principles to which we've made reference. And that's why we say we're going to get every information we can because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to sort out who's the best. Now, when Tiger Woods says, well, why should I be under the microscope because I'm in the lead or I'm televised frequently, that's just the cost of doing business. Mm-hmm. So when you're that good, you're going to be under a little more microscope than the player that was first off the tee. I really don't see we've made some adjustments in the rules about TV evidence that players couldn't possibly have known because of the technology that a rule was breached about avoiding some application of that rule then. But merely a call-in, I don't see that changing anytime soon. The RNA and the USGA are in pretty lockstep on this subject.
I think back to the time when Tiger Woods had members of the gallery remove that boulder, which was called a loose impediment.
Good. It was. But
it was a loose, I guess it was, because the rule stood. Ellen, I'll turn to you and with regard to another subject that the USGA is dealing with today, and that is the belly putter. Which is going to go out of existence, I think, in 2016. Is that correct? Of January 1st. What do you think about that rule change?
Oh, goodness. The guy in the middle or in the end, they're old. They're the ones that use that type of I'm just kidding.
I do.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I sometimes think – I wonder why – it wasn't tackled a little earlier. And that, I mean, Tommy, I know, probably knows the history of that. Because once – I think it's hard once things have been allowed to then say no. And I think people have more of an issue with that. I will tell you the belly putter does help. It is anchored. If I ever had to win and I got a little nervous, I think I would – I actually have demonstrated bending over, sticking my regular putter in my belly. And I practice that way sometimes when my technique gets bad because – you get a little nervous. Ask Tom Watson about what happens when you get a little yippy. You know, so it is an advantage, and then it's just drawing those lines, and that's why I have so much respect and why I will never be a rules official because it's a very difficult call, and I know these guys know a little bit more about the history of it. But
Jim, I'll turn to you. You have thoughts about that?
Don, I'm a traditionalist. I completely support what the USGA and the RNA did in this matter. I've gotten into lots of arguments with friends of mine, but I'm a traditionalist, and that's part of the game is being nervous. That's what it's all about. I mean, the fact that you could talk to Bobby Jones and Francis Ouimet and Chick Evans about anchoring, I mean, are you kidding me? So I do think – that, and I don't like bifurcate. I mean, the USGA, if it wasn't for the USGA, there wouldn't be this great game. So I'm all about that. But when you have somebody who's got some situation medically and that he's going to continue to play the game and he has to be able to anchor it to be able to play, I want him to be able to do that. Now, is he going to go compete? No, he's not. So it's a tough situation, but the USGA and the RNA did the right thing.
Okay, but Tom, I have to ask the question then. What about the new equipment, the titanium and the balls? Everything has changed, and you know, that's not traditional either. I mean, we can go back to Parsimon Woods, and that would be part of the old game.
Well, certainly the game has evolved technologically and in large part because of the capability of the manufacturers, not only the ball manufacturers but the club manufacturers. In many instances, those are the same people. that they have great skill and talent to be able to push the envelope technologically. The USGA is always trying to stay out in front of that. As it relates to the interesting, you used the reference belly putter, because there's another example of you're not uninitiated, because most people address it by referencing the long putter. And of course, the length of the putter is not an issue here. And I play with golfers all the time who use long putters but don't anchor them, so that, of course, will be permissible. Mm-hmm. It is now, and it is after January 1 of 2016. Ellen made a couple of interesting points that have been advanced a lot in this debate, and one was, why didn't we make the decision earlier? And the thing that I've been asked in my role, and I wasn't the president of the USGA when that was implemented, but I was the first vice president and was substantially involved in the debate. I said, well, look, I don't know what these other boards did. I wasn't here, and I've only been here for 7 years. But that doesn't mean you don't do it now because somebody didn't do it. I'm trying to raise a 15-year-old as of last Saturday. And if I thought, well, because he did something wrong one time, I wasn't going to rectify that or tell him that life guides you and teaches you that you should rectify it, I wouldn't be a very good father. The other part of this debate is that we saw substantial data that this method was being taught not just to people that Ellen and Jim referenced, like ourselves, older people, not as smooth, Tom Watson to the game, but this was being taught at the youth and junior level because Ellen said it definitely is an advantage. And we said in a very lengthy and open public debate, this is not, in our view, the definition of a stroke. A stroke is freely swinging the club away from your body. And what you focus in on the belly is really the belly putter is what really goes away here, because that putter is used more almost consistently or always by anchoring. But we saw that being implemented at the youth level, and that's when we said, okay, this isn't a PGA Tour statistic because players have used it, not used it. And some have been consistent, some of the younger ones. But this is about teaching kids to play this way because it does create an advantage. And that's when we stepped up and said, well, this is one of those times I told you that the governing part of this is not popular. Hmm. And this was a polarizing debate. A lot of people on all sides of it. And we were criticized substantially about it. But, again, if you're going to do this with conviction and diligence, you got to believe what you believe, and that's what we did.
Well, Tom, nobody said it was going to be easy.
That's exactly right.
That's Tom O'Toole. He's president of the U.S. Golf Association. He's with me in studio, as well as amateur golf luminaries Ellen Port and Jim Holtgreve. We'll come back and continue this conversation and take your calls at 382-8255 when we return. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation about golf in the St. Louis area and golf in general. My guests in studio, the president of the U.S. Golf Association, Tom O'Toole, amateur golf champions Ellen Port and Jim Holtgreve also with us. Ellen, let me turn to you with regard to what you're getting ready to deal with the Curtis Cup in June. Where are you on that? What's involved in captaining an event like this?
Well, funny that you should ask. Yeah. We just, Mr. O'Toole here just got finished calling four of our team. We have eight on the team, and we selected the team yesterday. So after, I guess, about a year ago, I was notified that I would be captain and have spent some time out there amongst the girls and kind of learning what my role is. And now it's finally coming to fruition when we pick the team, and they'll be coming to St. Louis here to practice out on St. Louis Country Club. And sometime in April, and then
that's where it's being played this year.
Uh-huh. And then the event's June starts. The opening ceremonies on June 5th, which is a Thursday, and then the competition runs the 6th, 7th, and 8th, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
So, what will you be doing with these young ladies during between now and then?
Having a lot of fun with them, marveling at their golf skills and their people skills, and it's a real honor to be a captain. I'll make some decisions. You know, I'll make some decisions as to how we're going to pair, how we're going to prepare. And first of all, how you prepare for an event like this. A lot of my players have already played on awfully big stages. They've been all over the world playing. The game has really changed. And so they're seasoned veterans in a lot of ways. So But, you know, they still have a lot to learn. So hopefully they'll learn a little bit. I'll hopefully stay out of their way and let them do what they can do. John Wooden always said the worst thing that coach can do is overcoach. So I'm going to try to heed some of those advices. But when it comes down to the competition, you just want to serve the players and set them up for success, you know. And I want to know each player individually. They're all very unique. They all bring something special to our team. And then the nitty-gritty is my biggest job is to put the pairings together, really, when it comes down to the event, because it's a Ryder Cup-type format. We'll have foursomes and four-ball. So you partner up, and then there's singles matches. And there's an order that you put at, and singles matches. And I have two great people who will probably give me a little bit of advice on how to proceed.
I overheard you asking advice of Jim a little while ago. That there is strategy involved. It's more than an honorary title, obviously. There is a strategy.
Right.
Right, Jim? I mean, you've done this with the Walker Cup.
Yes, sir, there is. But, I mean, it's like Ellen said, we can't teach these people how to play golf. I mean, they are very, very good at how they play. And I'm amazed is some of their ability in regards to chipping and putting the ball. I mean, everybody hits it a long way. But their accuracy and their determination around the greens is really, really impressive to me. And so it's just a matter of, I just really wanted to make sure that they understand how important it is to play for their country and what it is to be play for the United States of America. Mm-hmm. It's a greatest honor in sport to play for your country, sure. And so that was a big thing for me.
What's the average age of the golfers in Walker Cup and Ellen, your group, would you say? 20?
Our age was probably, with my two Walker Cup teams, probably the average was 20. We had... This past year in September, we put two mid-ams on the team. I'm thanking Tom O'Toole publicly now, because it was unbelievable, and it was just the best thing that the USGA could have done. Prior to that, we had Nathan Smith play on our 2011 team. He was the oldest at 31 years old. So, the average age is 20.
Before I go to the phones, there's one question I want to be sure to ask of you. Is I don't understand how you can be an amateur, turn professional, and then return to the amateur ranks.
Well, I'll tell you, that's the one thing that I wish I had not done is played professional golf. The only reason I am glad that I did it was be able to get closer to Mr. Palmer. I played golf more with Jack Nicklaus and Gary Player. Otherwise, and then meeting a lot of people in pro-ams and really being around the game. I went out there for the wrong reason. I went out there for the money. Mm-hmm. And the good Lord said, that's not the deal. And I learned the hard way, but it was, and then I basically applied for amateur status. I had not won that much money. And when I had talked to David Fay, the executive director at that time of the USGA, I said, is there a shot I could get my amateur status back? He said, yes, there is. And I applied, took 2 years, and I was hoping that if I did get it back that I would have a shot to become a Walker Cup captain. Mm-hmm. So I'm very grateful to the USGA.
Has that ever happened before, Tom, to your knowledge?
Oh, sure. We've never allowed somebody to have their amateur status restored and then made him a Walker Cup captain. Mm-hmm. He's the only person we did that for. But
for obvious reasons.
Bobby Lewis.
Yeah, but Bobby Lewis's professional career preceded his amateur career.
That's right. I'm sorry.
You're so,
right. That's
right. But by the way, the way these two get selected to be that is a couple of not only their great playing records and competitive accomplishments, but how they acted when they played on international teams, mm-hmm. and how they would represent both the United States of America and the United States Golf Association. So it's a tough and tall order to receive that stewardship. And, of course, Jim did it with great distinction for two Walker Cups, and we know Alan will be just as exemplary this June in St. Louis Country Club. So, but the restoration of amateur status is an interesting process. But, yeah, professional golfers have played even one on the PGA Tour and come back and gotten their amateur status back. But it's a long and involved process.
Let's go to the phone. Ellen,
no,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say for women, I think it happens. I haven't ever seen a statistic, but the young woman from Missouri played for the University of Missouri, had won the Mid-Am Championship this year, and she was a pro, applied for amateur status. I think a lot of times now people want to turn pro, yeah. And then they realize that either they can't make enough money or they want to go a different direction, but they don't want to give up golf. So
yeah, it seems to work differently for college players, yep, of football and mm-hmm, for things like that. Very quickly, before I go to the phones, is your event going to be televised?
Yes, it will be.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, that's
yes, it will be.
Wonderful.
Yep.
That's good news to you, Tom, I'm sure. Let's go to the phones. Karen, University City, thank you for being so patient. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon. It's a beautiful day for golf today.
Every day is a beautiful day for golf.
Yes. My point is addressing the more of the history. It's going back in time in St. Louis. My last name is Fogarty, and my grandfather was Frank Fogarty, who was the golf professional at Greenbrier Country Club for over 30 years. I actually grew up, that was my playground. And my great-uncle, Frank Fogarty, was the original PGA pro who was featured in Sports Illustrated back in the day. And I just feel like I'm very proud to be in a family that had a good, strong legacy of golf in St. Louis. Frank Fogarty at Greenbrier Hills, I can remember Sam Snead coming in and taking sand chipping lessons from him. And, you know, I can remember watching him hand building golf clubs in his basement for the members there at Greenbrier Hills. So, but I think particularly Jim Fogarty, having been the first PGA pro coming from St. Louis, is quite something.
Well, Karen, and, Karen, this is Jim Holgrave.
Yes.
Mr. O'Toole and I are just looking at some notes, and Jim Fogarty is the one that, when my dad started me at 4 years old at Sutton Country Club, he's the one that started me to play golf when I was 4 years old.
Huh.
And I'll add, he's the one that when my husband and I joined Sunset Country Club, and I didn't know anything about golf, that was the first one to take an interest and come over,
yeah,
and say something to me. And when, yeah, I found out what he'd accomplished and who he was and how humble he was, I was like, wow.
He was the best.
Well, they were both so very humble, and they loved teaching young people golf. I remember that very well. And they also had a brother, Pete Fogarty, who never became a professional, but who was a great amateur golfer, and they came from very, very humble beginnings, and I would love to have known more about where they played golf, and it addresses the subject of the fact that it is a sport for wealthy people. I know all the members at both of those clubs. You know, it's hard for people who don't have money to play golf. I actually live near Ruth Park now, and I get to see people there at the driving range and playing, but they were both just very, very humble people. Their view was that a golf pro works for the people of the country club, even though they had this, they were very, very beloved by people who knew them, and it was a wonderful upbringing to have, and they were both just really, really wonderful people.
And I
also just wanted to mention that I think St. Louis has just so many wonderful golf courses.
We do indeed, Kara. Thank you so much for the call. Talk about 6 degrees of separation. Everybody here at the table is connected with this phone call. I just wonder how much money Sam Snead took from Mr. Fogarty. he was pretty good at that, as I recall. Another call here. Jerry and O'Fallon, go ahead. You're next.
Good morning. Yeah, my first job, actually, I was a caddy at Norwood Hills Country Club when I was 14 years old. I learned a lot, not all necessarily related to golf, but I also learned the strategy of golf, and even though I've never been, you know, I can think good golf, I just really can't play it. But I've often, you know, my father-in-law has just turned 80, and I'm closing in on 60, and we're a pretty competitive foursome with my son-in-law and his brother, who are both in their 20s, when we play a scramble, because the kids have the power. They just, you know, a third of the time it goes at a 45-degree angle off a tee. But we old guys, we've got the placement, you know. So I think it's a nice thing for people to get interested in. And I hope, you know, there's some way to continue getting younger people interested in it, because it's not an old person sport, but you can't play it for virtually as long as you live.
Jerry, thanks so much for the call. That reinforces the point that we made a little while ago.
Absolutely. Tom? Well, it's right. It's a game for all ages, yeah. And I think one of the reasons all of us got attracted to the game was that we thought we'd have a lifelong love affair with it, and I think in certainly our instances we have.
See, that's what George Herbert, everybody asked me about, you know, Walker Cup. George Herbert Walker started this Walker Cup process to, this Walker Cup competition to build relationships and trying to bring back, after the horrific World War One. But just for him, Jerry, to talk about these relations, he's got an 80-year-old, 6-year-old, and 2 20-year-olds playing golf. It doesn't happen in any other sport. This is what's so great about our sport. They can have fun, and they're going to have relationships, and they're going to help grow, and they're going to grow their friends.
We are talking golf, and you're listening to St. Louis on the Air. Ellen, let me turn to you with regard to the women's game today, the professional game. This has really changed in the last couple of years, and as much as there's been this tremendous influx of Asian golfers. And that seems to, in the minds of many people in this country, kind of cause them to pull back from the appreciation of the women's game. How do you see that?
Oh, I don't know. I'll go back and say I don't think the golf ball knows how old you are, and it doesn't know what you look like. And I think that we just have to keep going back to that, that this game is for everybody that wants to play it and work hard. That's what I love about it, that, you know, when you go up there and you shoot the number and you do what you're supposed to do, I applaud that. And there's, you know, we could have this discussion forever. But, you know, I think that it's true that I don't know the percentages, that there are a high amount of Asians playing and having success. But that hasn't bothered me. You know, we all have an opportunity. I just think it goes back to prioritizing and what do you want to spend your time doing. Mm-hmm. What's important to you? What do you need? What's your motive for playing?
Well, I guess part of my point is it's strange to me that people would take their enjoyment ratio, percentage, if you will, on the basis of who is winning at that particular time. If it's not an American, then it's not so interesting anymore. That's just my personal observation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, Don, on that point, well, the LPGA Tour is like the PGA Tour. It's an entertainment industry, and they're trying to focus in on sponsors and corporate, not just corporate America, now global corporate involvement to, you know, perpetuate and promote their tour. I think Mike Wann, the commissioner of the LPGA Tour, has recognized that, and you look where he's taken the tour. He came on, they had about 21 or 22 events, and now they're up to 32 or 33 events by taking the game globally. That's where the growth of this game is going, is globally. So if you don't like different colored people's skins or their socioeconomic background or their race or their religious preference, this is a game that goes across wide outreaches. And that's what we've seen certainly in the women's game. And, you know, it's really important to the USGA because, you know, we have been shepherding women's golf since that room in New York City and December of 1894, and we still today have the most coveted title in women's professional golf and women's amateur golf for that matter. So it's an important part that we continue to cultivate this game across this globe, and people are just going to have to get used to that. That's part of this accessibility subject. It's got to be more welcoming.
It certainly means that it's catching on in other parts of the world, and that's good overall. I have to stop it at that point, lady and gentlemen. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Ellen Port, congratulations to you. Good luck this June. Tom O'Toole, thank you. Congratulations to you on the new job. And Jim Holtgreve, nice to see you again, and continued success in whatever you're doing.
Thank you all. Thank you for having us.
Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and we'll talk with the new principal timpanist of the St. Louis Symphony, Shannon Wood, about a chamber music concert featuring his work. Steve will also preview a festival of short LGBT plays, and in the next installment of Soundbites, produced with Sauce Magazine, he'll take a look at what it takes to make a successful restaurant. Monday on this program, we'll look at efforts to prevent lead poisoning in St. Louis. Then we'll talk with the writer and labor historian Jeff Cowie about his research, which inspired the play Soup Stews and Casseroles, 1976. It's currently playing at the Rep. Archive versions of this program available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. Thank you all so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.